is drawing near.
Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show sponsored by the Just Equal Justice Coalition. And it's a show where we are in conversation with leaders, community residents, researchers who are involved in efforts to improve the criminal legal system and its impact for all of us. You can learn more about our guests by going to the show notes on kkrn.org/bendingthearc. And you can find out more about the SEJC on our website, chastaequaljustice.org. This show is supported by KKRN, kkrn.org out of Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and also Redding, California, and supported by community listeners like you. Well, welcome to everyone listening, and I have the great pleasure of speaking today to Lindsay Briggs, who I met through an equity and advocacy committee group. I think we were invited to a board that Lindsay is on, and she's the perfect person to talk to us about the very non-controversial topics of abolition and carceral logic issues we have not yet addressed on this show. So welcome, Lindsay. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right. Thank you, Sharon, for having me. I'm excited that you asked me to talk about this issue. It's near and dear to my heart. I think it's something it's important to bring to people in a conversational sort of way, particularly breaking down academic sort of speak to lay person sort of speak.
Yes to all of that. I always begin my conversations with inviting the person I'm speaking to introduce themselves to listeners with whatever they feel is important to share, to ground the conversation and what's important for them to lead with.
All right. Well, my name is Lindsay Briggs. I use she, her pronouns. I am a queer woman living in Oroville, California, and teaching public health at the California State University, Chico. One of the things I think is unique about me as somebody living in California is that I was born in Indiana and did a lot of my growing up years in Indiana, which is pretty much the radical opposite of California. And so I think part of the things that make me unique and gives me a different perspective is that I sort of live in two worlds, right? The Indiana rural conservative sort of world, and then, you know, the academic liberal elite sort of world of being in California and being a professor. I think brings some unique perspectives that a lot of people don't have in these sort of ways. And that's sort of how I live my life in a lot of ways. I am an anarchist, so I identify as an anarchist, which a lot of people are like, ah, anarchy, that sounds so scary. It's, you know, the destruction of society and everything's just chaos. And that actually couldn't be farther from the truth. Anarchists have a fundamental belief that non-hierarchical structures are better than hierarchical ones, and so that nobody has power over another person for a sort of arbitrary means. And the idea that rules and laws and community agreements should be based from the people, not because they are, this is the way we've always done it, or this is how we think things should run. Anarchists really believe that people are able to self-govern themselves, and they should be able to do that. And that we might have different perspectives and expertise, but we are inherently part of a community, and we should be working on that together. Anarchism is really grounded in this sort of mutual respect and mutual aid for one another. And I think that's a really important part of who I am. I oftentimes don't follow norms in society when it comes to respecting authority or to, you know, bragging about my professional accolades if it has nothing to do with the conversation. And it also leads me to be a very pragmatic person, which I think is interesting for a lot of people because they, you know, they make assumptions about me because of how I look and who I am and other sort of things that they know about me. And then I'll come out of left field, so to speak, about something and totally blows people's minds. But that's because of my anarchism. It leads me to be a very pragmatic sort of person. I can have some very strong ideas and beliefs, but what is actually feasible and what is plausible and what is sort of the group leaning towards and thinking about and what is good for community may not be exactly what my belief sort of system is. And so I think, you know, I often say I have enemies just as much on the left as I do on the right, because I don't often fit into a nice niche that people are expecting me to. And I think that's an important part of who I am as a human. As it relates to my job, I am a professor. So I do have a PhD in public health. I do teach at Chico State. I do like to identify as a pracademic. And so pracademic is sort of a hybridization that puts practice at the forefront of academia, right? And so oftentimes academia gets this idea that we are these lofty, you know, ivory tower people who are not in touch with reality, or we don't know what the common man thinks or feels or other sort of stuff. And public health in and of itself is a social justice practice. And so we are grounded in the reality of people's lived experiences. I also like to say pracademic stands for practical solutions. What are we looking for? We're not looking at, here's a theory that we think is really cool, but what actually is going to work for somebody and work for systems, I think is really important. And then again, that pragmatism. I think it's important to be flexible as we move through things, particularly things that are big and sound scary, like abolition. How do we do this in a way that is pragmatic, that flexes with sort of the time and the community to get to the goal at the end? And I think that's a really important sort of practice. I talk a lot about carceral systems, both in my health equity class that I teach and in my mental and emotional health course that I teach.
Once we have framed something as, we can say equally, alt-right, anarchist, abolition, socialist, communist, you know, we see all of those terms getting thrown out as a, I don't have to listen to this anymore because I already know what it's about and I'm against it. On all sides, as you mentioned. So I'm wondering, when you are entering this territory outside of the classroom, how do you engage people in grappling with that?
I mean, I think language is something really important to me. So there's multiple answers, portion, steps, I guess, in your question of the way that I behave in my classroom is starkly different than the way I behave in public life, right? One of the things that I assume about my students is that they're there to learn, which means that they are very open-minded. And I can't assume that of the general public. I would love to assume that of the general public, but as you said, some people are really grounded in their ways. And so when I'm speaking to people in public sort of settings, I have to do sort of a quick check-in analysis of, are they actually open to learning and listening and hearing? If they are, I'm totally ready to engage them, and I engage them as I do my students. But I'm also very much somebody who is interested in sort of opportunity cost. What I think of is, I'm not going to expend my emotional and intellectual energy on somebody who is not actually willing to listen and to do the work. And so that oftentimes puts me in the stance of, yeah, I'm just going to walk away from somebody who is being belligerent and really just wants to shout me down or do these sort of things, because I don't have the unending reserve of energy and capacity to engage with people who are just there to be a bully or not to listen. And so that is a big thing to me. And I tell my students that, and I tell a lot of people that of I don't owe anybody a conversation. I would hope that I could have a conversation with a lot of people. And I do, as somebody who is trained in sexuality, talking about sex with people is the ultimate test of, can you talk to people from a variety of backgrounds? And I'm really skilled at that if people are open and willing to listen. And so that is my first sort of thing is, Who am I talking to? Is there an initiative and an ability to listen? If that is true, then I sort of go on in this realm. And this is what I talk about in my classroom of language is important. It is actually one of the most vital things that we can do because I think that it's everything. The majority of social ills and the majority of oppression, I firmly believe, begins and oftentimes is magnified through our language. I tell my students, you know, I'm not here to be a language policeman, right? I'm not here to say you can't say those sort of things because I, as an anarchist and as a pragmatist, am never in the business of telling people what they can and can't do. Although there are some limitations sometimes in my classroom. I tell people if they're going to be a jerk to one another, I do have the right to remove them from the classroom. But in the history of 12 years of teaching at Chico State, that's never happened. So it's not really a reality for me. Mm-hmm. Instead, I approach language in the way of thinking about it's a way to be kind. It's a way to be thoughtful and interact with other sort of humans. And so I ask my students to engage in that sort of way. We're learning better language because our language is expansive, right? We have hundreds of thousands of words in the English language. If somebody says this language hurts me or this language causes me pain, why would you continue to do that? Why would you continue to use that word? Do you have a right to? Absolutely, right? We have our First Amendment rights and we have rights as humans, but why? That's always my question at the end of the day. If somebody says, I don't like this word or I don't want you to use it in this sort of way, why do you feel adamant that that is the word that you need to use? And so that's how I approach language in my classroom and in general. I try to say, like, speak from I language of I don't like the way that you've used that word, or I feel uncomfortable with that word, or that word hurts me as a person. That way it sidesteps this debate about what is okay and not okay, what is you know, the prevailing rightness of a word is just to say, like, I don't like that. And anybody who persists in using something after somebody says, I don't like that, feels really jerky to me. And so how do we become more kind to one another? Even if you're like, I think this is ridiculous. Even if I think this word is totally fine. If somebody says it hurts me, why would you do that? And I think there's a fundamental just human kindness sort of issue there. And so that's generally how I approach it in my classroom. And so I tell my students, if I stop you because you say something that I know to be hurtful or problematic to a specific community or type of person, I'm going to stop you and help you figure out better ways to say it or to figure out a new way to use a word. And it's not to shame you. It's not to make you feel embarrassed. It really is to improve your language status and to help you connect with humans in a different way. And so I have found that to be very effective, both in my classroom and when talking in casual conversation with people. It's not to engage in an argument over the rightness or wrongness or who has voted for this word or not. It's to just say, this hurts some people, so let's choose something different.
One of the things, I love how you frame that and how you invite people into that conversation and where you make that decision not to enter a particular conversation. I think that's really helpful for all the things that we're going to talk about. And, you know, abolition is one of those terms that in the work that we do, many of our members are interested in criminal legal system reform. I would not say we have a majority of people by any means. We might have a couple of people who are interested in more broader systemic change. But there are a lot of misconceptions about, in my opinion, about what is meant by abolition by those who use it. And like the other terms that we're using, that you know, people take a position on anarchy without looking at the definitions or the terms or the impact or where it's been practiced, you know, all of those things. And so I'm really interested in hearing both how you think of and frame abolition and why you're passionate about it, how you engage people in understanding abolition on a, in a deeper way?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when all of my classes, when I start them on the very first day out of the gates, I self-identify as a hardcore leftist anarchist. And I think that's a really important sort of thing. And so there's this sort of temporary idea that professors and teachers should be politically neutral. We shouldn't show our bias. We should be a blank slate. And I think that just inherently is disingenuous. Nobody is bias-free. Nobody is neutered from sort of their political beliefs and ideas. And to assume that we could do that for our students is, I just think, absolutely ridiculous, number one. Mm-hmm. And so on the first day when I come out of the gate this sort of way, I tell my students, the reason that I'm telling you this is, number one, I want to be honest and vulnerable with you. I want you to know who I am as a human. And I want you to know where my perspectives lie. And then I say, in this classroom, I try my best to represent all perspectives, right? I try to give you, you know, here's sort of what, quote unquote, the left thinks. Here's what, quote unquote, the right thinks, to give them an array of perspectives. But also, I'm human. I know that I probably do a much better job of presenting ideas that I agree with than those I disagree with. And I invite my students from day one to say, you have every right in this classroom to, number one, do your own research and to investigate sort of the things that I say and to challenge me on these issues. I think it's a really important sort of practice to say that the person at the front of the room doesn't have all of the answers. They have answers based on their beliefs and on their experiences, but you get to have yours too. Because public health is a science-based practice, I ask my students to, you know, when you have formulated an opinion or when you want to argue a perspective, be prepared and ready to ground that in the evidence, right? We are an evidence-based practice. Mm-hmm. I want to hear where the research comes from. Where did you find this sort of information? Have you interrogated it for accuracy and bias yourself and those sort of things. But I think it's a really important sort of thing for students to know I am a human being outside of my classroom and I do have strongly held beliefs. To the best of my ability, I will try and temper those in the classroom. But also, I invite them to know where I'm coming from. So if they think like, oh, Lindsay didn't do a really great job of presenting this idea, they know why. They know it's probably something I don't believe in. And they have the ability to go and investigate that themselves. Of anybody in the world, professors are the most evaluated by anybody. Right. And so I have 12 years of evaluations, right? I teach 4 classes every semester. And so that's 8 evaluations over 12 years. So I have upwards of 90 evaluations, sets of evaluations. And each, you know, set has between 20 and 40 students in it. And by far, every evaluation that I get says Lindsay is completely fair in presenting all sorts of opinions and letting us formulate our own ideas. And a really important perspective that I start from day one to say, I'm going to present with a lot of information and I expect you to do the critical thinking on your own to figure out where you arrive at. And I think that's an important way to start this conversation is rounding my classroom in this sort of way.
Yeah. And I'll just say before we get back to abolition, I just worked on a paper on ethnography and evaluation, which is my core field, program evaluation. And we talked a lot about positionality, which came out of, you know, feminist research. And so me giving you my position actually helps more with your ability to see where I might have insights that you might not, but also where my potential biases might land, so that I'm laying that out for you. Here's the lens through which I see the world, my gender, my race, my perhaps my political leanings, my values, And so it's more constructed in that way, rather than pretending I don't have any of those and I'm offering you some neutral version of a clean version of reality. So I really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing. When I go into abolition, it is, again, a slow sort of progress. One of the biggest things that I ask my students to think about as we move into all of the coursework is how we use labels, right? This goes back to that language sort of thing. When we label people and when we create language based on largely on behavior or identity, those things we have to interrogate. What do they mean? What are they representing? Are they true? And so I think some of the things that as it relates to abolition is oftentimes we're labeling people based on sort of their worst moment or the worst thing that they've ever done, right? This person is a murderer. This person is a criminal. What does that actually mean when we label somebody in that sort of way? And so a lot of the beginning parts of my classes are unpacking the language about how we identify and label people and things. In particular, in most of my interests, is looking at the intersections of mental health, homelessness, and the criminal justice system. So when you hear, like, this person is a criminal, but then you find out that, they stole, a pair of jeans when they were off of their schizophrenia meds, and they were homeless and they were trying to figure out how to eat. Is that person actually a criminal, right? According to the justice system, yes, they stole something that is wrong and now they're a criminal, but they're also a mentally ill person. They're also somebody who was living in homelessness and they were trying to survive. And so unpacking those sort of labels that we have is really important. And I think that's the first step in abolition, is to think about how did somebody get into the criminal justice system? What are the things that happen there? And then looking along sort of the intersectional cleavages that we see of race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, the education system, all of those sort of things funnels back to this idea of, like, okay, this person who we've labeled a criminal, what did they actually do? And why did they do those sort of things is the beginning of unraveling sort of the carceral system, to say, do people actually belong in jail if they did something quote unquote wrong, but actually the context and the things that led them to do that wrongness actually are bigger than the wrongness in and of themselves.
So my mind's also going, getting back to sociology and the conversations I have with students. Often when we talk about some criminality or a crime, it's as if that particular crime has always existed as sort of a moral code above anything created by humans, when actually we decide in particular cultures and times what is a crime and what isn't. So moving from what we determine is a crime and how we, the impact of labeling someone as a criminal, how do you walk students into the next step of thinking about the systems we construct around that and sort of the logic inherent in those systems?
Yeah. Right. And so I talk a lot about sort of carceral logic and the idea that we have this imagination that if we have good guys and bad guys, if we have laws, those are the things that keep us safe. And so I talk a lot about the ways in which tools of social control have evolved over time. Right. So particularly when it comes to mental and emotional health, which is one of the biggest things that I work on. This idea that at one point, we locked people away in asylums, right? Because they were crazy or they were dangerous to society. Well, in actuality, we know that most of the people who were in asylums were there for not any particular reason, may not even be mentally ill. They just were deemed socially unfit. And we thought that if we lock these people away in asylums, it will make society better, right? And so very much a tool of social control. So, after locking people away in asylums, we realized the rampant abuse and some of the never-ending sort of stuff that happened in asylums. And so then we pushed for deinstitutionalization, which inherently on its, you know, sort of face value was a good thing. Yeah, people shouldn't be locked up, particularly for made up sort of reasons or other sort of stuff. But instead of having asylums and mental hospitals, we've largely replaced them with prisons, right? And so it's still, in this way, a tool of social control. This idea that we're going to keep society safer if we put people behind bars, that will make us better. But largely, we know that actually doesn't happen. We know that the criminal justice system is unequal in every measure pretty much imaginable. We know that longer sentences, more penalties doesn't make us safer. We have seen rising crime rates, again, interrogating what does that actually mean, across the country, even as we have incarcerated more and more people, right? And so this idea that laws and the criminal justice system exist to make sort of the common man, the common people safer, is inherently flawed in this sort of way, because number one, it's not carried out in any sort of fair manner. But also it is not a deterrent for anybody, right? People don't think like, oh no, if I do this thing, I'm going to go to jail. Oftentimes people are making decisions about whatever quote unquote crimes they're doing based on, larger picture sort of stuff. Is this a survival thing that I am doing? Am I doing it because I have other, I'm lacking other opportunities in these sort of things? I think being an abolitionist also inherently believes in the goodness of people, right? That people are inherently good. And I know that's probably a controversial issue because people often think like there are bad people and bad actors who do bad things. Mm-hmm. But I think that is bogus, number one. And I think oftentimes people are driven to do, you know, again, quote unquote, bad things because of other circumstances in their life. And so this idea that if we just have enough laws and if we just have enough jails, society will be safer and it will relieve us of all of these ills is a completely flawed understanding of humans. It's a very pessimistic view of what we are capable of. And it's one that I absolutely do not subscribe to in any way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm so glad that you in your classes present all sides, because I've witnessed or participated in conversations around this, and there's always someone in the room. The two things that seem to always come up among others. And one is, but what about those people or those groups of people, for whom we seem to have data, whether it's recidivism, which is kind of a circular argument, but recidivism data or other kind of behavioral health data that shows change is very limited. What happens to them, or how is that addressed under a system where there's abolition? And the other thing that seems to quickly follow that is, well, where has this worked? What have we seen in models in other countries or other periods where that would give us some confidence in alternative responses?
Yeah. One of the things that I often tell my students is that we actually don't have to have all the answers to every question that is presented to us. Just to point out problems and to say this isn't working is oftentimes enough. I often tell them, like, it's above my pay grade to have all the answers to everything. and so it's one of those sort of things that I like to point out of, what we are doing right now is not working in a very clear sort of sense, right? The crime rates are going up, incarceration is going up. People are no more happier or healthier than they have ever been. And so what we're doing right now is not working. And so I don't need to know what the possibility or what the definitive answer is. I know that there are possibilities for answers. And I know that it's going to take a radical restructuring of the system from a lot of perspectives to do these sort of things. And so what do we do with murderers or rapists, which is usually the biggest argument of like, well, does that mean you're just never going to throw a murderer in jail or you're never just going to throw a rapist in jail? I would say I don't know what we do with those people because we don't live in a system currently that allows for possibilities for other ways of holding people accountable and for making amends to people who are harmed. The one thing I think that is really important is that putting somebody in jail or even at the worst, putting somebody to death, right, under the death penalty actually doesn't make anything better, right? It might in a short term give you a sense of retribution or revenge, but in the end, it doesn't actually make you whole, right? The person who was harmed is not unharmed by these sort of systems. And so I think that's a really important sort of thing. And I think that is oftentimes what abolitionists challenge people to think about is what could it look like in a different sort of system? And so the majority of time, we are limited by our own sort of imagination. Yes. What would it look like to have a different system that isn't just locking people away, going through an unfair sort of system, relying on an external party to try and give us some sort of justice? I think there's a lot of ways that we could imagine something different. We're not close to that. And so I don't know what the possibilities are. And I'm okay with the fact that I don't have all the answers. And I often encourage my students to say that as well, of it's okay to not have all the answers, right? You don't have to know everything. But what you can know is that what we are doing right now does not work. And it is not okay. And it is harming people. And so we need to be open to a new interpretations, new ideas, new ways of being. In a contemporary sort of society, we don't have a lot of good ways of showing what abolition looks like, right? Because,
Because
all around the world, we have carceral systems. When we talk about possibilities of past examples of abolitionist sort of systems, those aren't based in today's modernity, right? Like, so oftentimes people will point to Native American communities and systems of restoration of harm and these sort of things. But oftentimes you're talking about societies that lived hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, where we didn't have modern technology, we didn't have modern weapons, we didn't have a lot of the stuff. And so I think arguing for a return to those sort of times is, again, disingenuous because those are our societies that look very different from ours. And so whatever the solutions were in those societies aren't going to work now, right? Because they didn't have Snapchat, right? They didn't have iPhones. They didn't have nuclear weapons, for the love. We can't make those direct comparisons. And currently we don't have any systems in the world where we really see no sort of carceral system present. And so we really do have to open our minds for imagination of what that could look like. How could we do these things better? Because right now we're not doing those things. But what we are doing just doesn't work.
Yeah. And I love that language of imagination that's really present now in social justice work. And you're pointing to not only imagining systems, but really imagining and looking, sort of doing the inner work to see what do we really mean by public safety? What do we really mean? Is our carceral system about, you said, you know, revenge or punishment or paying back into society through isolation? Or is there something different that we want to achieve, that difference between more restorative justice model and I think you use the word retribution, which others use too. What do you see are, I guess I have several questions around how we can work collectively or individually to reimagine those core concepts about, you know, even below carcerality, about public safety or what we really want to achieve out of that, then, you know, some of the solutions may be more clear.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the biggest things that I talk about in all of my classes is the defund police movements, which a lot of people, you know, balk at of, well, we can't take away money from the police. But I think we deconstruct what does defund movement mean. Defund movement means we should stop giving money to the police state and to carceral systems and instead use that money on things that are social service based. And I think that is a really important step in the movement towards abolition, right? It is a horrifying statistic that a lot of cities spend almost 50% of their budgets on policing, right? That's true in the city of Chico. It's true in larger cities around the country that a large majority of city budget, meaning taxpayer sort of money, goes to policing. And again, are these policing systems making us any safer? No, they aren't. And so if we were to start scaling back and say like, okay, well, you're not going to get 50% of the budget because we're going to take that money and invest it in social services, right? In public health, in behavioral health, in housing assistance, in food assistance, all of these different sort of programs, how might that have an impact on our communities, right? If a lot of the crimes that are happening are because people are stealing to get their needs met, if tempers are flaring because you're hungry and you don't have the ability to feed your family, you're cranky over that, all of these sort of quote unquote crimes that are happening are oftentimes the end result of unmet social needs. And I think we should be focusing on that. And so defund police movements really are about taking the money that right now goes to police departments and utilizing it in a way that actually invests in a community, in ways that people can be fed, they can reach their mental health sort of needs, they can get their needed medical care and services, that they can feed their family, that they can take time off. All of those sort of things do inherently cost money, and that money could be better spent in other ways. And so a lot of what I talk about in my classes is how do we move funding from one place to another? Public health is chronically underfunded. And so I tell my students that of, you're not going to be rich in this career because we are often underfunded. You will oftentimes be asked to change health outcomes, but given little money to do those sort of things. Well, I know there's a big giant pot of money that we could utilize in a lot better places, right? The idea that, like, you know, a ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is something that originates in public health, right? If we invest in communities on the front end, then we don't have to invest in them on the back end. And that is what policing does, right? We should be investing in our communities so that people have their needs met. And then we will likely see crime rates fall because people won't have to resort to doing things that oftentimes puts them into contact with a criminal justice system.
You're also bringing up this sense of, I think when people hear abolition, the image that comes by is, you know, we vote and next month there's nothing. And you're pointed to all many different abolition-based responses. And I think you're also talking about a continuum, not that we, end everything tomorrow, yeah. Whether it's, you know, capitalism our whole criminal legal system. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that, how people can sort of approach understanding how one might make changes based on what we're seeing that's not working.
Yeah, right? I think, abolition as a whole has been a continuum and progressively changing movement, right? Abolition, our earliest sort of ideas of abolition were rooted in slavery, right? The idea that people owned humans and were able to control them. So abolition started as, hey, we shouldn't be doing this anymore. And at the time, people were like, what? Like, this is crazy talk. How could we not have slaves? And now the idea of that is so reprehensible. And so that is where abolition started, right? And we worked really hard for a really long time. The fact that it took hundreds of years to undo slavery was a big sort of thing. But at the time, we couldn't have imagined where we are now. And so this is, again, that sort of back to the imagination. After slavery did fall, and though it did fall overnight in terms of writing the Emancipation Proclamation, we know that it continued on in terms of the 13th Amendment, so that prisons exist as a form of slavery, and Jim Crow, right? So thinking about how unequal people in this country, Black people in this country, were treated even post-slavery, right? And so we see abolition as a movement already as a continuum, as a progressively changing sort of thing, right? It went from slavery to Jim Crow to civil rights movement, and we've added more layers to it at all times. And so we have to continually think about these sort of things. While abolition right now mostly focuses on the carceral state, meaning prison and cops, it also is something that we think about in terms of war and military, any sort of way that we need to move towards the fact that movements or structures and institutions that deprive people of their human rights are things that need to be abolished, right? And so whatever it is that is preventing people from living sort of their best lives is something that should be abolished. And it's going to be continually changing dependent on what our society does. And so I think that's an important sort of thing. It's why we look at history, right? Because we don't want to repeat the future, but also to see how things have changed over time. Abolition has meant many things in many ways over time. And so right now we're focusing on the carceral state of how do we have, you know, reform in the system, with maybe the end goal is abolishment of the carceral state. But you know, if it took us hundreds of years to undo slavery, which was now what we think of as a pretty easy sort of thing, if you don't get to own another human being, in hundreds of years from now, people might look back and be like, wow, why did we ever think that prisons were a good idea? And so, again, it goes back to that imagining possibilities and back to my sort of point of being a pragmatist of, yeah, what is acceptable to communities right now? And when I talk about funding public health and funding social services and funding things that cause social ills, oftentimes people can get on board with those, not everybody. But that's the first step in saying, okay, well, we got to move some of these public funds around to focus on prevention rather than on adjudication and punishment.
Yeah, you're making me think of one of my earlier conversations with a mobile outreach response team from Hill Country Community Clinic. And I was asking the folks who were there if there was anything that had surprised them about their work. And one person who had been with the team a couple of years said that they were really surprised at how many expressions of mental health issues really had physical health root causes, which is not a surprise to you, right? But, you know, everything from a urinary tract, an untreated urinary tract infection by someone who's living unsheltered, to, you know, hormonal changes, to being off medication or the wrong medication, and really emphasizes that importance of, wow, what could have been prevented with preventative care and attention to basic needs.
Yeah, I think it's key. It's you know, the reason that our mental and emotional health course is one of the foundational courses that all of our public health majors have to take, At the beginning of the semester, I'm like, why are you taking this class? Well, because it's required. But by the middle and towards the end of class, why do you have to take this class? And they're like, how could you have a degree in public health without talking about mental and emotional health, right? It is sort of what we call like the sandwich of health, right? Anything that is happening on a mental health level is going to affect your physical health. And then anything that's happening in your physical health world can also affect your mental health. And so mental health surrounds a person in every aspect. And it is absolutely impacted by your environment. It's impacted by your social condition. It is impacted by literally everything. If you are not doing well financially, that is a stressful sort of situation. If you have a mental health crisis, it's going to impact your financials. If you can't go to work, if you can't support yourself. And then all of these things trickle down into this sort of a thing that makes people desperate and makes people do things that puts them into contact with the criminal justice system. And so, yeah, at the heart of everything, in my sort of beliefs, is that mental health and its connections to being untreated, homelessness, those are the areas that we really need to be looking at and focusing on as we work our way up to abolition.
You're reminding me of, we've done a lot of work, and perhaps in Chico, they have two around ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences, nonprofits in particular. But it was a while before I saw in one of those trainings, there's a visual, the pair of ACEs. So it has all the things of the 10 point, you know, ACE scores at the top of the tree, but the roots are really in discrimination, poverty, untreated health conditions, racism, all of those things that can give rise to the ACEs that we're so concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. All of those things, your day-to-day sort of struggles have such an impact on your mental health that, yeah, makes you unavailable to your children, or makes you react to your children in ways that may not be desirable, or that you have an impact in your life in terms of incarceration or substance use, that again, it ends up in ACEs, right? And so if we want to think about how do we best care for children who you know, tend to be the innocent and the vulnerable in all of this, well, we've got to start thinking about our social systems and how do we support communities so that they aren't dealing with the stress and the intersection of all these things that cause trauma to percolate up to people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Are you involved in any social movements or collectives that help, well, give support or kind of learning collaboratives around these issues, aside from the actual, you know, people who are doing the work that you're doing on health equity?
I'm involved in a lot of stuff, but the thing that actually first perked into my mind when you said that is a very unconventional way in which I am involved. As you know, social media is everywhere and everything. Mm-hmm. I was part of a social media group on Facebook that was a collective of people engaged in mutual aid. There were some scuffles in that group. And so I started my own group. And it's now one of the largest sort of buy nothing groups in the Chico area. It's called Actual Anarchists Trading Goods in Butte County. And it really is the simple idea that is founded sort of on anarchist principles of mutual aid. A lot of people just, you know, give stuff away on there of like, oh, I have this, you know, like old exercise ball I'm not using. Does anybody want it? But also we have created this robust system of helping one another without the confines of systems and sort of government. And so, you know, earlier this week, somebody needed to move, but they couldn't lift their couches and some of their heavier sort of stuff. And so they put a call out into the group of, you know, I'm in a desperate situation. I have no money to pay, but I could really use, you know, just 2 hours of a couple of strong people's assistance to help me move this furniture. And people showed up and helped them do those sort of things. Sometimes people will say, you know, like I've been unemployed for a bit, but I have a job interview. Could somebody give me, you know, $10 to get a tank of gas so I can get to my interview? Those sort of things. And it really is one of the most beautiful things that I've ever participated in, is this very small scale, person to person sort of mutual aid network that really makes a difference in people's lives. Sometimes it's small little things and sometimes it's goofy sort of things, but this direct meeting of people's needs, I think, is really important. And that is what the group does. And I really just started it on a whim because I was mad at another group and started it. And now we have, I think, 2,500 people in this group. And, you know, I when I started it, I said, you don't have to be an anarchist to join the group, but you do have to believe in anarchist principles to be in the group. Which is that mutual aid is inherently good. We don't engage in any sort of isms, so racism, oppression, other sort of things. And you know that you come and you give with a whole heart to help your fellow community member. And it's a pretty basic sort of concept. And I recruited a couple of friends to help me moderate the group so that when issues come up, again, I'm not the sole arbiter of things, but we have a small group chat where we talk about like, hey, this thing came up and what should we do about that? And hey, here's a thing. And there seems to be some community discord over this sort of issue. And yeah, we are largely self-regulated and we meet a lot of people's needs in this very general, generous community-based way. And so it's one of my favorite things that I participate in that has no grand aims of, you know, revolutionizing sort of society, but it really helps people on a day-to-day basis.
I love that, Lindsay. I'm going to check it out. And is it okay if I put the link for people who are interested in joining? And yeah, that's a great example. It kind of goes to a question I often ask of what's giving you hope currently. Is there anything else that is giving you hope right now?
Yeah, I think there's, trying to think. I there are so many things that I'm either tangentially related in and other sort of stuff, union movements, social movements. One of the things that I run at Chico State is the Transgender Task Force, which is a community group. It's based off of obviously Chico State, but we allow a lot of people into it. And the idea is that we just want to make the community better for trans people. How do we do these sort of things? And we talk about issues that crop up. Again, most of the things that I think make me happiest and give me the most hope and resolve to keep going are non-structured sort of things. And so that is what our transgender task force does, is people bring up issues and, hey, here's the thing. Let's work on how we solve this as a group. Who has resources? Who has time? What do we do in these sort of ways? Getting updates from various places in on campus and in the community, I think is a really important sort of work. How do we look for liberation and justice for trans people? Both just on a small scale sort of stuff. I mean, sometimes, you know, national politics and other sort of stuff comes up, but for the most part, we're looking at issues here and now. What happens when a trans person is misgendered on campus? What happens when they don't have a bathroom to use? What happens here? And we as a group come together and solve those things. And so I think a lot of hope for the future requires us to invest in our own personal communities, right? I think politics and political movements are important and big, flashy sort of organizations are great. But at the end of the day, it's the communities in which we live and how we have an impact on them that have the most impact. And so how do we advocate for the homeless in our community? How do we advocate for the mentally ill in our community? How do we advocate for people who are being treated unfairly in our own community? that is going to create the most substantial change, those sort of human to human moments where we are meeting people's needs in the here and now is much more important to me than big picture, global scale sort of stuff.
That is a beautiful place to end, Lindsay. It really resonates with the all that's being said about change being internal first and human to human as we address some of those systems. So thank you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes. Thank you for having me. It was an enjoyable conversation and a good week of thinking about why do I do the things that I do and what is important to me. And so I appreciated being able to think about these things all week.
You're shining, you're shining. Everybody come on, everybody come on.